It's Plan B with Rebecca Davis. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, John.
How's your poetry knowledge?
It's top notch.
Okay.
You're going to put me to the test.
Well, we've established that a poem called Acquainted with the Night is not a poem by Emily Dickinson. It caused me an immense amount of psychological stress to get that established, but we did. So who wrote Acquainted with the Night?
No, I'm afraid I'm going to have to pass. Give me a clue. Give me some initials.
R.F.
R.F.
Yes.
Robert Frost.
There we go.
Do I win a big prize?
You win, when it's safe, a hug from me.
Oh, John, you old so-and-so.
I have been one acquainted with the night. I have walked out in rain and back in rain. I have outwalked the furthest city light. I have looked down the saddest city lane. I have passed by the watchman on his beat and dropped my eyes, unwilling to explain. I have stood still and stopped the sound of feet when far away an interrupted cry came over houses from another street, but not to call me back or say goodbye. And further still, at an unearthly height, one luminary clock against the sky proclaimed the time was neither wrong nor right. I have been one acquainted with the night.
A gorgeous rendition, John.
Thank you. Right, what are we? What we're talking about first, and I think it's a very, very interesting topic, Rebecca, because I'm very interested to know something about it. Does activism work?
Yeah, so the question was one raised, I think, in a very timely way by the Race Foundation, who funded this study, looking at activism in South Africa and posing this question. And obviously there are limits to the report, but the conclusion is basically yes, but it's also noticeable that some of the greatest activist victories that they list are at this stage old. So, for instance, the Treatment Action Campaign's victory for antiretroviral drugs in South Africa. I mean, I think that's almost indisputably the greatest social justice victory in South Africa since apartheid. But we're talking 20 years ago now, you know. Since then, they list campaigns like Fees Must Fall, which the impact of which was actually quite limited, a 0% fee increase for 2015, additional funds for the missing middle, but we know that have actually had some knock-on effects. And then there have been, you know, a number of impressive legal victories by the likes of Equal Education when it comes to what schools should have. But the question is there implementation of what the courts then hand down, and the answer is too rarely. Unions have succeeded finally in getting the national minimum wage implemented. So in short, John, there has been, you know, some impressive victories by these kind of campaigns. They also list the Zuma Must Fall campaign, which is interesting because that to me is not necessarily an example of a kind of movement from the NGO sector per se, even though there were organizations behind it. To me, that was much more of a mass mobilization, middle class, sort of general social driving force than an NGO campaign per se. But what I was interested in, John, was this issue of funding, because, you know, we see a lot of this nonsense in social media about how, for instance, George Soros and his Open Society Foundation can cause regime change in countries by, you know, laying down what he funds and what he doesn't want to fund. And, you know, there's a fragment of truth in that, actually, in terms of what donors internationally want from their funding. So, for instance, the report notes that donors will often not fund any protest activities which kind of flirt with illegality. And what that means is, for instance, if you're an NGO who wants to carry out some kind of radical land protest, like land invasions, you're not going to get international funding to do that kind of thing. Donors want maximum reach, which means that over 80% of South African activism takes place in urban areas because there's just more people there as opposed to rural areas where it might actually be more needed. And donors want bang for their buck, which is why so many of them are most prepared to fund litigation. You know, we see the government constantly being dragged to court, and it's in part because of this, because you can say, give me your money and I will take the government to court to sue for X, taps, toilets, whatever. But the question is that, you know, these are actually quite kind of niche areas that money is going into, that donors are saying, we'll give you money to do this, but not that. And it actually does have an impact in, on kind of, you know, the whole social justice framework of the country in a way that's really interesting. And the answer, of course, is perhaps that there should be more homegrown philanthropy, more local philanthropists willing to give funding without perhaps such stringent conditions, and of course government funding, because it's these NGOs, often the service ones, who are filling the gaps that have been left by government itself.
And then how does Cape Town score in an index of cities offering quality of sleep?
So the 2020 Sleep Index, John, compares the conditions of sleeping quality in 75 cities around the world. And what it does, it looks at 9 factors contributing to the overall quality of a person's sleep. And that's mental well-being, physical health, so that looks at obesity rates, the number of gyms, how much caffeine, nicotine, and alcohol is consumed, all of which will make you not sleep well, overwork, the cost of living, your stress, chronic pain, and that's likely to be more the case for older citizens, so younger cities tend to have less of this, environment, which is air, light, and noise pollution, and then just how much, on average, citizens are sleeping. I can report that the city in the world where you will get the best sleep, where people are sleeping the best, is Amsterdam in the Netherlands, followed by Auckland in New Zealand, and perhaps surprisingly, Glasgow in the UK. So there's a list of cities from 1 to 75. I'm disappointed to say that Cape Town clocks in at a not very impressive 54th. But it is ahead of the likes of Dubai, LA, Tokyo, Sao Paulo, which is the worst, at number 75. And funnily enough, New York, which is famously the city which doesn't sleep, is not actually the city which doesn't sleep. It's only at number 64. So there are other cities which are considerably worse, in fact, for sleeplessness.
Please help me how I can read facial expressions behind or through or above and below a mask.
Is this something you genuinely struggle with, John?
No, I don't care.
England's Daily Mail, a tabloid of repute, has published a whole article this week giving helpful tips to people on reading facial expressions. Because apparently now that everyone's wandering around wearing a mask, or at least they should be, everyone is totally at sea when it comes to interpreting even the most basic responses from other humans. Are you happy right now? Are you sad? I just can't tell. So, John, you might, for instance, be interested to know that, I'm quoting, many people are sharing troubles right now. It's important to show concern via eye expression. The eye shape itself needs to be softened while the brows are pulled into a gentle frown. A small head tilt signals active empathetic listening. I can just imagine you pulling that off quite successfully. Now, if someone is looking at you blinking very quickly, John, they may have something in their eye, but they may also be angry. That is one of the signals. And the sign of love, of course, of affection, of attraction, is someone looking at you with their eyes narrowed slightly, softened with some gentle crinkling at the outside edge. The comments on this article made me laugh out loud, one of which was, it is indeed the sign of the end times that we have to be given these kind of clues on how to read our fellow human beings. But should you need it, go to the Daily Mail forthwith and find out about facial expressions.
And then I am piqued, and that's E-A-K-E-D, not Q-U-E-E-D, that you wrote to me. There are two words in the style report that I am almost certain you are unfamiliar with. Pelvage and ilium. You clearly do not understand my status as fashion guru to the broadcast world.
I clearly do not. Tell us, John, please educate us. What is the ilium and what is pelvage?
Well, I know what the ilium is. It's the top of your hip. I did anatomy many, many years ago, so I know that. I'd never heard the ilium in a fashion sense, and I'd never heard or read the word pelvage, but I thought, what is it? Is it dresses are now, the V is going down so low now, it's going down to the pelvis, so instead of cleavage, it's pelvage. But it's not that at all.
That would be a very, very dramatically cut dress that extends to there. No, pelvage is the new cleavage. The pelvage is now the exposure of the ilium, the two concepts being linked. John, I'm very impressed that you knew what an ilium is. I actually did not. So when I was reading this, I felt like I had taken a very special kind of drug. The pelvage requires the exposure of the ilium. The ilium is, yes, as you say, the largest and uppermost part of the hip bone, forming part of the pelvis, hence the portmanteau word pelvage, which is refers to when you have either something, a part of your clothing cut out to expose the hip bone, or I suppose you could simply be wearing your clothes in such a manner that your ilium is exposed. Either way, it is quite the thing to do, John. It was on display at the SA Style Awards recently, all the pelvic, all the iliums. Or should that be ilii?
Iliums. Iliums.
It is possible to get lost, but John, next time I see you in the flesh, I trust you will be exposing an abundant amount of pelvic.
If you'd seen me earlier in my ripped six-pack days, many, many decades ago now, I would arrive at dance class during speech and drama training, and I would drive it in a cropped rib top just under, so I would expose this extraordinary abdomen to the admiring gazes of all. And then I would roll down my tights so that I was exposing my ilium. I was exposing this beautiful Matham flesh between my ilium and just below my nuptials.
John, I mean, that is an erotic picture. The word tights in particular, I think, really has us all quite hot and bothered. Thank you for that.
You're always welcome. Rebecca Davis with Plan B.